Welcome to Beauty at Work. We are in between seasons at the moment, so please enjoy this clip from one of our episodes.
If there was no hope of finding a beautiful formula, people would not do this job, right? I mean, because at the end of the day, the old operation of mathematical physics or theoretical physics is to replace something very complicated with something very simple. And that's another aspect of the beauty of it, right? That you have a huge, complicated physical problem, and then you discover that there is one formula that, at least in principle, contains it. You know, and if this were, if the one formula was 100 pages of formulas, nobody would care to discover it. You know what I mean? The simplification is part of the beauty of the process. It's the reason to do it. If you couldn't find something like that, there would be no point. You would just, you know, try to do a numerical simulation, particle by particle, but that would not be as interesting. And now the thing is that, so that's absolutely inevitable. The point is that, of course, our mind is not the mind of God, so to speak. And so sometimes there is the possibility of falling in love with a beautiful formula and expecting that that should be it, you know, that because the formula is very mathematically elegant in its simplicity, in its richness of its structure, then that's the way the world should be. I mean, again, a famous example in my field is the Maxwell particles, you know, that when in the 19th century, after Boltzmann wrote his famous equation, the great British physicist Maxwell discovered that the equations simplify enormously and you find some super elegant solutions if the particles in question are attracted with a force that decays with the fifth power of the radius. So these are called the Maxwellian molecules. So every kinetic theorist thinks that if I was God, particles in the world would attract and repel each other with a force that decays with the fifth power of the radius, which is not the way it is, because, you know, typically particles like electrons or ions, they use the second power. You know, the Coulomb force between charged particles is 1/r², not 1/5. And that's a pity, because, you know, kinetic theory would work much better. And there is, generally speaking, this situation in which, for some strange reason, a lot of physical problems sit at the most hard to capture choice of parameters. Like a famous example is, again, the 1/r² interaction, which is typical of gravity and electrostatic interaction. And I know at least three different theorems that everything works for r, say, less than 2 or bigger than 2. But when you get to r equal 2, everything, all your math starts falling apart, right? And so there is a way in which, you know, reality sometimes does not correspond at the simplest, what we would correspond beautiful because we understand it, but sits at the boundary of it. And this drives mathematicians crazy sometimes. I mean the typical example of this beauty is the way people have been trying to, you know, like, again, theoretical physics, all this you know, the standard model and stuff, people use that as a criterion, and you have this, and sometimes it works, you know? I mean, I'm always impressed that, you know, the way the number 3, for example, pops up in very strange ways in physics. You know, like, there is 3 dimensions, and that's very, if you wish, Trinitarian, because there is one space in 3 dimensions, and it is inseparably 1 and 3. You know, it is clearly one space, but it's clearly triune, right? It clearly goes in 3 directions. Or you can find, oh, I like the, you know, the example of the quarks. You know, the quarks are organized in 3 triplets, so it's 3 squared. But Nothing, but all, so there are all these beautiful numbers, and of course the people who invented the like Gell-Mann people discovered quarks wouldn't care about the number three in particular, but they certainly were much more attracted to a theory with three triplets than if it had been, I don't know, 6 times 7 or something like that. You know what I mean? There is a certain elegance, a certain beauty to, for example, simple numerical groups or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, is it so how do people proceed? I suppose in theoretical physics, one of the challenges is this sort of drive towards simplicity, towards unification, even trying to develop a unified theory, right, of physics is something again that's very contested. Is that worth investing in? Is there reason to believe that reality at its core must be so simple as to be contained in a single equation or something like that? Or is that a waste of time? How do you think of that?
Well, I remember you were telling me about, you know, Wigner's sentence about the miraculous effect of mathematics.
Reality, the unreasonable effect.
Reality hints. I mean, there is again this experience that reality hints to very simple, elegant general principles, which at the same time always escape us, you know, so whether it's worth it. I mean, I think it is worth it, like it was worth, you know, building great cathedrals, you know, if it is in a strict practical technological sense. Some of these things at some point are not worth it, but it is one of the few areas in which our time does something gratuitously, you know, in which we do something just for the sake of the beauty of it. So, I mean, I don't begrudge the people who want to do that. I mean, the idea that science has to be useful, of course, within reason, is not correct. I mean, it is a spiritual activity in some sense. It is like also like poetry or art. So I think it should be pursued within reason. Whether reality, ultimately, we are going to find the formula for everything, I don't think so. I mean, there is simply the problem of scale. You know, there was an interesting book by, I don't know if you know, David Bohm, probably, right? You know, David Bohm, the American physicist, his case was that physics will always be incomplete because there is always the next scale. You can always look at something bigger, something smaller, something on shorter time, something on a longer time, and all your models at some point break, right? So if you go down closer and closer to the Big Bang, closer and closer to the microscopic Planck scale, at some point you need to change the model because it will stop working. And so there is, in that sense, a certain infinity to physics. But what is remarkable is that within certain scales, you can describe the world with really elegant, simple mathematical models, and that's an amazing thing.
Yeah, how do you make sense of that? Because it's, I mean, from say like a strictly, you know, evolutionary standpoint, there's no sort of reason to expect a priori that reality at any level could be, you know, described with what human beings, this sort of insignificant creature on you know, a planet that's on a, you know, insignificant galaxy somewhere in you know, in space, can actually grasp the workings of what seem to be laws that cover the expanse of the universe, right? What is it about? How do you, as a mathematician, I guess, you know, make sense, or how do other mathematicians make sense of this unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics?
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know whether it's really that unreasonable, you know, in the sense that, you know, the world presents itself to us with a remarkable consistency, right? I mean, I don't know, it's not like a dream, you know. Like, you know, recently I had a dream in which, you know, in a dream things keep changing randomly. One second you're clothed, the next second you're naked, the next second you're back in Europe, then next second, right. It is like the world is like a random association of images. Well, I mean, even without mathematics, the world does present itself to us as very stable in some sense, you know, nosologically stable. I mean, that that it doesn't act up random. You know, I mean, there is obvious regularities, and when there is regularities, there is math. You know, I mean, it is not surprising in that sense. I mean, what could be a world like a random sequence of dreams? You know, I mean, I don't know. It's a difficult question, I guess. But what is striking is more the, how can I put it, how, again, it can be boiled down to certain very simple general features, right? I mean, it's like, you know, that you can, because you could have a regularity that, again, fits in order to describe the world, you need to have a huge number of equations, for example, not just a few. I mean, that seems to me, you know, again, you could describe, I don't know, like I always, another very striking, for example, set of equations is, you know, general relativity, the Einstein's equation of general relativity. You can write them with 1, 2, I mean, I cannot count for you, but 6 or 7 letters, and all of the physics of very complicated systems are in those 6 or 7 Greek letters or whatever they are, if you interpreted them correctly. So it's a unreasonably, if you wish, simple model. I think that the simplicity is more striking than the existence of a model when it is simple. But then again, also the simplicity is, again, is deceiving, because then when you try to solve the equations, they are unbelievably difficult, right? So what is striking is that there is a simplicity of concept that contains an extreme complexity of behavior. I guess that's what's interesting to me.
What are the limits then to what mathematics can tell us about reality?
Well, it's abstract. You know, I mean, this is true of physics in general. I mean, it abstracts one aspect of life. You know, I mean, I always give the example of a beautiful statue. You know, you go to the Louvre and there is the Venus of Milo, and she's sexy. You know, she tells you about Greek history. How did she get, you know, there is history, there is the human aspect. You can also you can measure the electrical conductivity of the Venus of Milo. You know, but you are abstracting. I mean, physics does not ultimately know reality. Knows reality, the scholastics would use the word qua, Q-U-A, right? Now, for Thomas Aquinas and company, qua means with respect to, in the sense of, right? So physics only knows reality in as much as it can be measured in certain ways. You know, it can measure length, weight, conductivity, luminosity. You can measure things. But, of course, our experience of reality is much more than the experience of reality as measurable, right? We experience reality as beautiful. We experience reality as useful. We experience reality in terms of personality. We experience reality, even physical reality. We just don't experience it as measurable the way physics knows it, right? I mean, physics cannot tell you, again, if a body that falls down a window is a true gem that's worth $1 million or a stone of the same. You know what I mean? It can tell you the chemistry, but not the value, for example. You know, questions of value, they're all economic dimensions. It's not, anyway, I'm talking too much about a very simple point, that physics abstracts one aspect of reality, but in order to do that abstraction, to extract this aspect of measurability and reproducibility, you have first to take in the world as a whole, right? And so the mistake is kind of to reduce that experience to the ensuing process of quantitative abstraction. Does it make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, so those abstractions are helpful to provide certain kinds of descriptions, but they don't really exhaust other kinds of categories.
Yeah, exactly. Provide the kind of descriptions according to some aspect of the experience, right? I mean,
right.
You can tell me if I jump off the window, physics can tell me how long it will take me to hit the ground, but that's not a lot about me. You know what I mean? It's not.
Right, right. So, I mean, we typically associate beauty with art, right? With the sort of visual art or music or architecture or fashion and so on. But if we took, say, mathematics or even physics as a starting point for understanding beauty, what could that give us? Is that, could we learn something about beauty that we typically don't think about?
Well, again, I think that there is the, you know, an aspect of beauty is its universality again. I mean, the fact that there is something that in the particular you find something which is universal. I mean, and so that the, and the other aspect is that, again, the aspect of finding unsuspected relationships, you know, the way things are connected. I remember it was, I think, the great Italian philosopher Rosmini said that the nature, the definition of beauty is unity in diversity, right? And that's an interesting concept because beauty is not never uniform, right? Beauty can never be just a blank slate, or it cannot just be a complete jumble of differences. It is a beauty always involves relationship, right? I mean, beauty always involves a relationship between parts. You know, you think of a beautiful Greek temple. It's all about the proportion of the different parts, the columns and in the top, and they are organized according to certain proportions. So beauty really is capturing this unity and this relationship between a diverse experience of reality and bringing it to unity. Okay, so if that's the definition of beauty, that's certainly found in mathematics and physics because that's precisely that. It takes in a limited realm, right, in the realm of quantity, it does establish connections between different statements, different observations, and brings them together in a unified picture. So I think that's what it is.
Yeah, no, that's really helpful. I mean, one of the things that when we've been studying scientists for a few years, and when they talk about beauty, whether biologists or physicists, the common experience of beauty that where they really find profound beauty in their work is in understanding. So this is the ability to grasp the hidden order or the inner logic of systems, and to say, that's how things are. So there's a coming together of things, but also an experience something being revealed to you, reality somehow revealing itself or disclosing itself, and grasping a sense of how things come together in that revelation, and that seems to be, you know, that phrasing of this is how things are has been, I found it echoed by poets I've interviewed, for instance, as well as scientists, and so there seems to be something in common across fields. I wanted to ask about whether there's any sort of spiritual dimension to mathematics. I mean, I think, you know, for one reason, I think of people like Frank Wilczek, the Nobel Prize winner, who said that nature embodies beautiful ideas, and those ideas are expressed in mathematics. So, you know, as though Galileo, I think, said, you know, mathematics is the language with which God is writing the universe. But I also think about Islamic art over the centuries, particularly in their golden era, when so much of Islamic art was essentially like complex mathematics, it seems, embodying itself into various patterns. And I wonder whether you see any connection between mathematics and sort of the religious or spiritual sense in human beings.
Well, I mean, as I said before, mathematicians tend to be very Platonic. I mean, they tend to believe that there is a world of ideas. And, you know, and I always say that one of the trends in modern physics has been towards increasing mathematization of physics, meaning that, you know, in the physics of the 18th century, in a sense, bodies were extraneous to each other. I mean, it was the physics of artillery. You shoot cannonballs, you study the trajectories, and you use the math to do that. But at the end of the day, the body, the solid, rigid body, like the cannonball, is like kind of a given. Matter is a primitive concept. Now, the trend of physics has been towards kind of breaking down matter into, again, mathematical structures. You know, if you look now at modern physics, it's not clear what that there is matter. There is all these, you know, representations of the Poincaré group, they're called, or whatever they are. You know, when you study an electron, at the end of the day, in the standard model, you have this very sophisticated mathematical structures, and then somehow this sophisticated mathematical structure manifests itself as a tennis ball. But reality has been kind of disembodied by modern physics, you know what I mean? Because it's become so clearly identified with these sophisticated mathematical things. I think that that's the reason why mathematicians and physics, I read some statistics, but you are the expert, tend to be more religious than biologists. Is that right? I mean,
it seems to be to some degree, yeah.
And I think that if it is the case, that's because they ultimately all their work is about assuming that the mathematical organization is primitive, is at the root of reality. While to some degree, biology is more like 18th century science. You know, it's like a machine. You're like a mechanician who dismantles a watch, a clock, and see all the different parts move together. And then you bring them back together, but it's not as mathematized as physics, for example, right? Or even chemistry. So I think in that sense, mathematicians and physics would have a very hard time to say that, you know, that the mathematical realities don't exist. Because it looks like, in fact, mathematical realities exist and then give us the impression of matter. But matter has become kind of a meaningless concept. You know what I mean? What does the word matter add to the standard model? You know what I mean? You could argue that once you have all this group theory and Lagrangians and all these things, then there is the world. But why is it material? Mm. So this is also a problem with, you know, at the end of the day, I think in the modern world, materialism just means predictability because it means determinism, maybe, perhaps, even after quantum mechanics is kind of problematic. But, you know, again, to a physicist, matter has been kind of boiled down to math. And then what can you really say that math does not exist? Well, we live immersed in it in some sense, you know, at least from a perspective of a theoretical physicist.
Beauty at Work is brought to you by Templeton Religion Trust. If you enjoyed this clip, go check out the full episode. And please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a review. It really helps get the word out about the show. Thanks, and see you next time.